Hi, my name is Andrew Finsness, and I am 34 years old. Today is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, so what is it, the 24th of November, 2018, and I am speaking with Genevieve Giblin, as that's what she prefers to be called these days, Gigi, who is my grandmother, and we're recording this in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in front of a beautiful fire in my home. Gigi, I wanted to ask you, first of all, just what your childhood home was like. Who lived in the house with you, and what did your room look like?
Well, the first room that I remember that was not one that I had just heard about was in New Jersey, and it was in Roselle Park. And it was a bedroom I shared the bedroom with my brother, and he was 3 years younger, and I was probably about seven, eight and nine. And so it was a bedroom where, particularly I remember, the one thing I remember, that my mother made bedspreads for these twin beds.
Yeah.
And I never knew she could sew before. So that I was so astounded that she could make something. Because she was not the kind of person that whipped out her sewing machine ever before. And here she had all that talent that I thought.
So did Nana sew on a foot pedal?
Oh, no, no, it was, or was not. It electric? It was sort of electric.
Yeah.
But it was just that she did that one thing and never did anything else. Before or after. She wanted these certain kind of bedspreads, and that was what, and the reason I think I might remember it, Andrew, is because they took pictures of my brother and me in these beds.
Yeah.
And I probably still have them.
Uh-huh.
And we're both sitting up there, us and the bedspreads.
That's funny because I remember us saving sewing for when you guys would come to visit.
Yes, right.
Maybe it was patching. Yeah. Oh, it was definitely patching. Right. Yeah, it was like just fixing stuff.
Right, but yeah. Right, yeah.
I remember because Nana would be like sitting around, like,
she loved,
you know,
to
like
it.
Hanging out. Like,
and I think she loved to do it because she could always be the only one that could still thread a needle without taking much time.
Uh-huh, I remember that. Yeah.
Sounds so funny. That's the thing about my house, though. I lived in a house that was, the family house was one that had a very big porch on it.
Uh-huh.
And it would have, winter time, they would put this glass on it. In summer, they'd put screens. And I remember when I went back to New Jersey as an adult, I could not believe how small the houses were compared to how big they seemed in my imagination. And how narrow the street was.
Yeah.
I used to love to skate on my street, and especially the street over where it had a better
surface,
right?
You roller skated?
I did,
yeah.
I definitely did. And so we were not supposed to go on that street, but we did do it anyway. And so, and it also had a brook in the back of the yards of the other people's houses, but for some reason we had no problem thinking it was a terrible thing to go through other people's yards to get.
That's fine. I mean, that's what I love. I thought it was ridiculous to not go through people's yards.
Well, in California, you know, everyone has a fence.
Yeah.
So it kind of gives you an idea that that's not your territory.
Yeah. What was that, a suburb, or was it? Did it feel pretty
it was
rural?
A suburb.
Or
I would, yeah. No, never rural. I've never lived only once in rural. This was a suburb. It would be like one of the first few rings from New York City, because it was easily reachable by train, and right from train to New York City.
When did you live somewhere rural?
I lived rural in Hollister, California, when I was a junior in high school, and for about a year and a half. And it was a really wonderful thing because I did not like where we were living already, where we had come to from New Jersey, and this was rural, and I liked it, and they had so many things to do every weekend.
So is it different, like you went to school in somewhere in California, then you went to a different high school?
Yes, I went to, when we came to California, yeah. We went to Vallejo.
Uh-huh.
And so we stayed there, but that was at a time with when you worked after 1 year, you could then get what they called a RIF, which was reduction in force. And my dad was hired for 1 year, and after that it was like you got your pink slip or whatever you want to call it. And so he did not have a job anymore. So we moved down. He worked as an electrician. And so we moved to Hollister.
So you went, and then you went back to Vallejo?
We did, because then they called him back. That was what the government would do.
Because he worked for the government?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so after they reduced their force, some other reason would happen. And so we were just about ready to go back to New Jersey, because we never really embraced it and loved it yet. And we went back even for Christmas, just because we were lonesome for our place. But actually, so we went then and moved to back to Vallejo.
Okay.
And so the one thing about it, I will say, it was a something I've questioned later. I must have been really annoying or something, because I so much did not want to move to Vallejo. And my parents were always very easygoing and indulgent with me. And so they let me stay to complete the semester. And so I probably stayed for, you know, a month and a half, or maybe longer, I'm not sure, in Hollister, but they all moved back to Vallejo. And I stayed.
Oh, you did? With who?
Just this family, this random family.
Really?
I walked in, like, with my suitcase, and that was, hello.
That's funny, because when you said you were down there, I kind of thought it was something you did on your own for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Okay.
What was really funny about that, Andrew, was my parents. It wasn't that far away. It was 150 miles or something, 100. But they would come down and visit me every couple weeks or something. And when they would, we would all sit in the living room, and it would be so awkward.
Because you were in this other family's house?
This other family's house, and my family has never been a sitting in the living room family. We were always doing something else, whatever we're doing. And we're not sitting there, and probably there was no TV then, or we didn't have one in that family. So we were all just sitting there like we were visitors with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But we really didn't
with your
what
family.
To say.
Yeah. That's funny.
So anyway, that was my experience there.
Thank you.
We did live in an orchard.
In an orchard in Hollister?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of apples?
It was
or?
Actually walnuts.
Walnuts?
Walnuts.
Walnuts take a lot of water.
Right, they do. It may not be walnuts
whatever.
Anymore.
Yeah. What about your parents? You said they were easygoing. And that I know that your father went out for a job initially, and what else can you tell me about your parents and what they were like when you were growing up? Because I only knew Nana when she was
pretty
old.
Dad.
But yeah.
And that's one of the things that as a person now that's a grandma, I realize that I feel really lucky to, although you may not remember me when I was younger, I always remember you.
Mm-hmm.
At all ages.
Yeah.
And so I feel kind of sorry in a way for grandchildren that they only walk in and get to meet the grandparent when they're old, in bed or something, and sick.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's true in a lot of cases. I don't think it's true in your case
not
at all.
Case, no.
But, yeah.
But I mean, that was one of the things that I've thought about a lot lately, only because, like you said, you didn't know my dad.
No.
To me, you were... My dad did meet you, and I remember specifically when we met you, and the day, and well, we do have a photograph of that as well,
I
so that jostles the memory, and I don't know if you want me to talk about you or just me, but
it doesn't, you know,
if it's
all
right.
I picture the fabric that's in that picture. There's a fabric that he's wearing, I think, that is like a checkered, like plaid, like
right, probably because he developed in his older years as someone who really wanted to dress up nattily, and which he didn't do while he was working, he didn't dress that much, but he did then. But by that time, he was an older person, and we were sitting on the couch waiting for your mom to bring you over, and it was in Alameda, and we did. when you came, you had a very strong voice,
mm-hmm.
and you expressed yourself for quite a long time. And my
expressed
dad,
myself.
That's why my dad would really put it. I'm just saying the way he would really think of it. He said, you know, he wouldn't think in terms of this baby's hungry, or you know, it's got gas or something. And whatever it was, you didn't want to stop, even though we did everything else we could to make you maybe not cry, so mm-hmm. you could have a baby that wasn't crying. But you were not just crying. He thought you were expressing yourself. So he said, let him know. He never wanted to hurt anyone's spirit. And so he just thought, let him cry. He's got wonderful lungs. And it's, you know,
how did he express himself?
Well, he was not very, he was not a big talker, but he was kind of a dog whisperer sort of person. I think about all the wonderful things, but he was never like telling you in a way that you would resist or resent it. He would just plant ideas, like when he would read me stories or be talking about his ideas, and he'd be carrying around a book, Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
And Plato. I actually don't know if he ever read it. I'm not saying he didn't.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I didn't see him reading it and I didn't read it. But
do you suspect he didn't?
No.
Did he seem like someone who's trying to put on airs and look
smart?
No,
he never.
Okay.
Totally not that.
Okay.
But he probably would do maybe like I do.
Intend
I can read
to
one,
read stuff?
No, I can. No, I can read something, but actually one paragraph can give me enough food to think. I don't have to read the whole chapter. I can't read the whole chapter because I get filled up with enlarging and thinking about the
mm-hmm.
first paragraph.
Yeah, no,
and
I think my
dad was like that,
mm-hmm.
and so he was. I'll just share something that I have shared recently, but. But one of the things about him was, you know, he took your mom and he also took his wife, which is my mom, and me, and Bridget, on a trip across. First we went across to New York City from San Francisco area on train, and then we all converged and went on this repeat of an ocean voyage to France.
Mm-hmm.
And so he treated us all. But he was not a person of much means,
mm-hmm.
the way a person could just do. And it was also a very extraordinary thing to do. That was probably in 1964, 65. And the Berlin Wall, I think, was still, everything was still just recovering.
Berlin Wall was,
it was recovering from the war then.
Yeah.
It wasn't like out so mm-hmm. long ago. And so it was long enough ago, but it was not the people were.
Only 20 years. I mean, 20 years is not that
while.
Long. You know?
But it was, the main thing was that nowadays, everyone that wants to fly to Europe does it at some time. But at that time, it was just a very out of the blue thing to do.
Yeah.
But he thought of that. And he went back and went several times. And but the main thing was his generosity of wanting his grandchildren to see it.
Did he, what did he do most of his life for work?
He was an electrician who earned his apprenticeship after he had his family, and he went to night school.
Okay.
And he learned to be an electrician and got whatever.
So Eddie kind of followed in his footsteps
a
little bit.
Well, he was a little bit like that.
Because
you're right.
Eddie ran
was
power,
a lineman for Pacific Bell.
Yeah.
And the other thing that he did, which was not just that, he had a hobby. And he taught himself how to do not only take pictures with this wonderful camera.
You developed
them? Developed
them.
And they, my parents had a developing room in the bathroom.
I didn't know that.
Yep, he did that. And one of the times he was in a contest.
Yeah.
And connected with his class that he was in. And I was always a rather curious kid.
Mm-hmm.
And when the very few times they would go out, I would certainly like to check out what was going on. And so I found his camera and this little square in it, and I removed his picture and ruined it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what ever got into me, but I told him that I did it without him finding out first. And he said to me, well, since you told me, I'm not going to be angry with me, but never do that again. Which I felt so rewarded for telling the truth that he didn't get mad at me.
That's a level of like child rearing that I bet a lot of people that age didn't have, and now still don't. But you know, it's definitely what they tell you to do. The thing about having hobbies, I think, is interesting because I've been someone who's picked up hobbies, but my parents don't have hobbies, like, really so much. I mean, a little bit, but, like, something that I've kind of developed on my own. To hear that he had hobbies is interesting.
He did have hobbies. Yeah. You have no idea how advanced my dad was.
Yeah.
Because he was, there's someone named, and even today there's an apple cider vinegar Bragg that they make a natural one. But my dad got a whole set of books, and he got us to eating so far back. He started with diet.
Yeah.
And he didn't want us to eat sugar, even then, which, of course, we did keep the habit of eating sugar. But he didn't make, he didn't enjoy it.
We felt guilty about it, at least. At least that's a good, honest Catholic
we
guilt.
We didn't have as much as everybody else had. No. Sugar. Never did.
Sugar or guilt.
Oh, he didn't want icing. He didn't want gravy. He didn't. And it was all about, now, a lot of the theories may have changed.
Uh-huh.
But the point of it was that we were certainly geared, because you are what you eat, is what his theory was. And so we were always never eating canned stuff, never eating, you know, none of that.
Uh-huh.
Always eating whole wheat bread, which is certainly not what I wanted to eat, but had to have.
Yeah,
bread.
Well, that was right when all the stuff was coming out. I mean, World War II is why all that stuff was invented. You know, I mean, you know, all the canned, all the innovations in preserving and canning and processing food was to facilitate war.
Oh, you're right. It's true. And I wasn't aware of any of that stuff.
And so after the 45, then it came into the consumer marketplace. And then it was in everyone's lunches.
I never realized that they didn't have that before.
It all got developed for World War One. Napoleon was when canning was invented. Yeah. Just water bath canning was Napoleon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to tell you this one more if you have room for one.
Yeah, plenty. Yeah, whatever.
When we came, my parents were always the kind of parents that would do some mumbo-jumbo talking, and they would say some little crazy words together, and they would say they each knew what they were talking about.
Oh.
But they just had a certain camaraderie that I always thought everyone had, which I found out everyone doesn't.
How did they meet?
Oh, I have no idea, truly.
Were they high school? Or
No. Actually, you know, my parents were both orphaned. And so...
Oh, I guess I knew that Nana... I always think of Jean as being... being orphaned, but I don't... I mean, obviously, they both would have been. Yeah, like,
my dad was... His father died when I think he was... I'm not so strict about the year, but I think he was, like, under 18 when his mother died. Or around that, and maybe about 12 when his father died. Wow. So that he was alone.
Yeah.
And he did have some sisters, but they were not all good sisters.
Did he graduate high school? And
But he did that at night school.
At night school.
And after I was born.
So he didn't graduate like when he was 18?
He was probably working somewhere.
Yeah.
And helping his mom because she was in the process of dying.
Yeah.
And so... Then my mom was, you know, orphaned at an early age.
13 or something?
Well, 13 for her, maybe for her mom, and maybe 17 for her dad.
Yeah.
And so the point of that is that both of them were people that were sort of alone in the world.
Yeah.
They had nobody to fall back on, for sure. And so that formed who they were together, I think, and it formed... how my little family was.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, and that was one of the...
Well, I was going to ask if you went back to go visit people in New Jersey, but there probably wasn't, when you went back for Christmas, anyone to go...
Well, one of the things the relationship with my dad and his sisters was never warm.
Mm-hmm.
And so we might have seen them, I think, in my entire life while I lived there, I only remember maybe seeing them four times. Hmm. It doesn't mean that there weren't more times that I don't remember.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like the way the family that I have here, how you all are with the relatives, and how my my California family is getting together Christmas. And
your parents formed it. It's a new start from them.
Yeah, well, so
kind of.
It was probably easier in that one way for them to go to California.
Well, that's the American story right there, is leave your old whatever behind and go to
leave behind except Eugene.
And then go to California.
I mean, right. But going to California then was such a different thing, because it was a lot of illusion in a certain, because there was not all this instant access to pictures and everything that people have today.
People were, California, when I was a kid, California was a mythical place.
Yeah.
And it's still, now it's a place with a lot of connotations, but it's like, it's symbolic of a lot of things to the rest of the country, but it's not a mythical place in the same way as it was.
It's not like a wonderland.
That's
true. But for us it was. But the main thing was that this was during the actual war still going on. So my dad had to get permission from the government, even though he was going to work at a government job. They were different branches of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in order to buy gasoline, you had to have...
Because there were gas rations.
Stamps.
Yeah.
And so he had to have actual documents and certain towns, and there were at least three.
So you had to have like papers to move, essentially.
No, to get by gas.
To buy gas.
No, not to move.
Not to move, but to
just
buy
to
gas.
Just to buy gas, because we could only get so far. And we had these little books, and they would run out. But because we were taking an extraordinary trip,
we had
to maybe go to Ohio and some other place where we found the office. And he had to go there.
Oh, he had to stop and get them the way?
In person.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was kind of interesting.
I'm going to get a beverage, and then can we keep going? Is that okay? What was Elizabeth like when she was growing up, and do you have any favorite stories to share about her? Thin ice.
Oh gosh, it opens up a bunch of stories.
Doesn't have to be, and we can skip it too. I've got more. Yeah.
I feel free to say pass. I feel, there's a lot about your mom that you probably don't know, or you do know she had the operation, but you don't know how that was.
I don't know anything about how that would be as a parent.
Yeah, well, it was not good for me because I was so young. And
How old were you?
Well,
I mean, I'm not trying to do math or anything.
And I don't ever know. But I could tell you that I think that Elizabeth maybe was not 1 year old yet.
Uh-huh.
And I just took her to this doctor.
Did you know that she was sick or not?
No, she wasn't sick at all.
Yeah.
She was a perfect baby. But when he listened to her, he thought he detected a heart murmur. Good night.
Love you, Kate. Nice bathrobe.
I'm going to wake you up in the morning so we can both... But you'll be awake. You can probably wake me up.
Yeah.
Even though I said I would set my clock.
Yeah.
Sweet dreams.
Oh,
so you're saying you see he detected everybody, that was a murmur or something?
A heart murmur, and then that was alarming because we were just going to go on a little trip down to Los Angeles. But there was no signs of any kind of thing. But he detected that, and then so we followed up, and it turned out she definitely did have a heart murmur. And so it just so happened that I was taking her to a well baby clinic. So there was this doctor who was from San Francisco, a very good doctor, went to that. And so when he heard Elizabeth, then they followed it up. And
he said it was more than a heart murmur?
Yeah, it turned out that there was, then we went on to the Presbyterian Hospital in San Francisco, and it turned out that it was a congenital heart defect that may have occurred when I was, it may or not have occurred when I had a fever while I was expecting her, and something that was supposed to normally I'd see it was supposed to close. It didn't do, so it created and actually, if this operation wasn't available, they said she would only live to be 30 if she was.
Oh, living. it was till to 30, but the operation was brand new, right?
Yeah, but they didn't have the machines yet.
Okay.
That heart and lung machine was not up and running.
Uh huh.
So that required waiting for that machine to be ready.
So the machine wasn't in, didn't exist.
No, they didn't have this. This guy, and none of it was ready. And I didn't have any expectation except that everything was supposed to go well for me. And so I felt very bad. Why did this happen to us? You know, what did we ever do? That, you know.
Well, the way that you said it reminded me, because I've done a lot of research about mental, like, psychology and relationships and parenting and stuff like that. And one of the things of to mothers that they've done historically is blame them for their kids' shit. like autism, for instance, has often been blamed on mothers not being affectionate enough, which is bullshit.
Right.
But and when they say, oh, well, maybe when you had a fever, well, they have no idea. They're just, it sounds like they're being bad doctors blaming mothers for their baby's problems.
Well, mine was deeper than that, Andrew. Mine was like, God, why did you do this to us?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
It was not just like me. I was okay that I did have a fever. And
yeah.
Maybe it was because of that, and I didn't feel guilty. But the part that I felt bad and angry about was, why would this happen to us?
When you think about stuff like that, which I'm sure you're thinking has evolved since then.
Yes.
But do you think, why did God do this to us? Did we do something to deserve it?
No,
or do
I didn't.
You just think, geez, we're unlucky that this thing is going on?
I thought we were really not supposed to have things like that happen to us.
Well, that's I think that's the human condition, is that we feel like we're not supposed to have things like that happen to us, whatever it may be. You know, like, yeah.
And I didn't think that, I mean, I felt like you know, tried to be a good person all the time, and I thought that was kind of a guarantee that things would go well.
Yeah.
And things were not good there.
Even when I have thought about stuff like that intellectually a lot, because it's the kind of thing I like to think about, still, when I was in the hospital a year ago, I was thinking, why did this happen to me? What did I do to deserve this? Well, you did tons of stuff to deserve it, actually. There's literal linear consequences.
Like a list.
But you still just start thinking that way.
Yeah. You know? And I was, you know, as I said, very young. I don't mean just young in numbers, but I hadn't really done any reading or anything much to make me, like now, if a person was even as young as that and they had been experienced any Buddhist thought, they would know that comes, that's part of life.
Yeah.
And then you're not
dukkha.
Yeah, right, exactly. But you would, if you were not brought up that way, you'd think it's supposed to, you do the good stuff and everything good, you know, comes along.
Yeah.
So anyway, we had to wait that long period from when we first discovered it till, I think, Elizabeth was 3 and she would have been 4 in April when that operation.
So it was a couple years.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But that weren't just like.
But you knew that it wasn't.
Things were getting worse.
They were getting worse, but you didn't think that anything bad was going to happen in the interim? Was it a risky period of time from what they said?
Well, the bad things that happened, there was like 3 bad things. Physically, she did start to stop thriving.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. And physically, her nails would turn. No, I don't mean they were blue, but they were pink.
Mm-hmm.
And so physically that
you could see it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And actually, as a young, overcompensating mother, I was afraid to get her upset. Because if she cried, I was afraid something would happen. You know, I didn't have any medical background. I was just not wanting to upset her, which would be very upsetting. So that would happen so many times. And so that was not hard. I didn't know how to manage that.
What was the first time you remember wanting to explore something else spiritually? Because, like, I'm someone who has always been, although I'm like a seeker, like you. I feel like we're both seekers to some extent. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like you know, ask all the questions you can of Christianity while you're in that sphere. Mm-hmm. And then figure out that's not going to work for you. And then kind of start asking questions of all the other spheres. Mm-hmm. But I imagine in your, when you were going through that, it was just a different questions being asked, mm-hmm. and answered. And what, you know,
right, I do understand. There's only one thing I just want to pick up on what you said, that I don't share this. I'm not saying that either way is right or wrong, but I'm saying I don't share that Christianity didn't work. And you might have been just using words, but what I have chosen to do is embrace each part. Nothing I've found yet has ever refuted the other thing, because I always have been picking like a Columbus word anyway. I've taken the things from what I grew up as, brought up as a Christian or Catholic, and if I didn't like the thing about birth control, I didn't follow that. Mm-hmm. And so I've never been a whole 100% person absorbed in, I like drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the way.
Yeah, I was projecting my own path onto my question.
I just wanted to say that there's an embellishment when you don't just take one, because I didn't drop that, and now I think that's a foundation that made me want to aspire to be sort of a good person. I think of as a good person. And Buddhism doesn't contradict anything there yet. Nothing contradicts.
Mm-hmm.
It just amplifies everything.
Yeah. And I guess what I, and by including my own conclusions, I was steering the question in the way I didn't want to, which was more just, when do you remember wanting to ask the questions?
Well, you know, I always ask questions. I remember in my own mind, I would think, when I would be in Catholic Church and they'd be explaining all this, I'd think, well, I don't believe that. You know, I've just never been able to just accept what I didn't really believe or find believable. But I think I didn't really pursue very much until, even the first thing I think I might have really dabbled with was when I took the first yoga class, which would have been when I, let's say I might have been 40, just to give you a time frame. And this teacher.
So the kids are gone.
No, not gone.
Well, not gone.
Yeah.
Not gone, but they're getting older.
So, in other words, I kind of had segments that I was the daughter, then I was like the wife, and the wife of the principal person, and the sort of the mother.
Uh-huh.
And
that thing too. Yeah.
I've heard Elizabeth say that. She's brainwashed.
She was raised by some other people. I'm not sure who they were really, but
I thought I was taking the job seriously.
I don't know. I heard the grandparents raised her, but
anyway. So the thing was that I took this yoga class, and this woman said, now, when you take yoga, it could change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yay, I'm always willing to change. You know, I'm always willing to change parts of my life. But some people, she said, some people do not like this.
Uh-huh, the change.
And they do not want to change your life. They don't, I mean, if they know that's going to change your life, they're going to opt out of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that wasn't the yoga, although that introduced me to chakras and lots of ideas that are Eastern ideas, but I never did any of the things like marijuana or any of those kind of enriching things, you know. But so she was connected with a group that was later, some people called a cult, and it was called Esoteric Christianity. And so this, I realized later, had a lot of expansive ideas in it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them was the simplest thing, how mechanical we are.
Uh-huh.
And so, and in searching how to not be mechanical, we were very mechanical about how to not be mechanical, if you understand. Just stopping using the word I. Mm-hmm. And we would intentionally say, this person. Well, after about a week of that, anybody like Bridget in the house, me calling.
This person wants you to. This person would like you to clean up your room. Your name is Mom. Just,
because every time you'd say I, you would think at one point before that you were I, and you say I and you mean I. But we have 1,000 I's. Mm-hmm. This I wants that, and that I wants that. And so that was the point of it.
It's the ego dissolving. Yes, to not right. Call yourself I all the time. Yes, because right. if you acknowledge that you aren't the center of everything.
And not to identify with your word I.
Yeah.
Being able to say I, because this I says yes and the other I says no, I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
This I says I'm going to get up at 7, the other I said no, I don't want to.
Told you about Why Buddhism Is True yet, the book?
No.
Did I tell you about that?
No, I don't know.
Oh, so I got into that and I hate the title because yeah, why anything is...
Right away you think it's not, you know.
Exactly, why anything is true is isn't my way of thinking, and it's actually it's a little bit more about Buddhism as a religion. It has more history to that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was actually was a neuroscientist who's into Buddhism talking about how the neuroscience behind the brain lines up with Buddhist ideals. Mm-hmm. And how there is no self, you know, CEO self, and how the mind, you know, actually has different modules, different eyes. Mm-hmm. That each have their own thing that they're kind of doing.
There's so many.
Yeah. Yes. And that we just think of them and compile them as one. And that's actually the way that the mind actually physically works as well.
Right.
When you're talking about the mechanics.
There's like maybe a philosophy or way of life, but this is the actual, the brain. Mm-hmm. That you're talking about. And the science backs it up.
Was there a person or a thing that prompted you to go to that first yoga class and introduce you to those people?
I don't know how I came across that, to be honest. I just really don't know how I met her first.
Uh-huh.
And then from her, she would mention this group she belonged to. And this other person and I were not in that group, and her name was Claire, and we both were, it was so magical what mm-hmm. she talked about, what that group did and what they thought. So we wanted to get to go to the group, and finally the other one invited us to go to it. This had a leader, and mm-hmm. it actually bought a winery.
Oh yeah?
It is still, I think, going on, Renaissance Winery.
The winery still goes on.
Yeah.
But is Esoteric Christianity still around?
It up. There was, as all things in human experience, things come together and go away.
Uh-huh.
Now, so maybe a lot of the people left for one reason, personality reasons or whatever. I left because it was very hard, and personally, it was hard financially.
Yeah.
Because they kept giving you more tasks mm-hmm. that you had to pay for.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do it anymore, so I had to actually mm-hmm. quit. Also, it wasn't a good thing as a married person to mm-hmm. be sort of going this way, because usually many of the people would divorce, but I never
uh-huh.
did do that. I didn't do that.
Yeah.
But it was kind of making a person change.
What's interesting about the change thing that you said was, along the Paul Stamets and the How to Change Your Mind book that I'm into and everything, one of the things, his dad or one of his relatives said to him, hey, I'm old now, and you've been talking about how this hallucinogen stuff forever, I'd like to do it with you, you know? And he said, well, honestly, I don't know. I know I've told you about how great it is and everything, but you're at a certain point of your life where this could change your life. And for a lot of people, it's not comfortable to change their life at this age or ever, you know?
Right.
And so, just so you know, I'm only going to do this if actually your wife will too. Because if have a complete change in your perspective of life and she doesn't, you guys are going to not have a harmonious end to your existence together, or necessarily. And so you should probably, if you're going to do this at this point in life, you both have to. And she said no, and so he didn't do it.
That's right, because people that I met, one of them was Don and Doris Burrell, and he was the one who designed the Nut Tree when it first came out, which was like a dream.
The Nut Tree?
The Nut Tree restaurant.
Okay.
But your mom would know. It was like something that nobody had ever seen before. Uh-huh. It had such an exotic, and an atrium in it and things. That's why now it's not there anymore.
Well,
they were in that group.
I can imagine. I mean, I think I'm judging and don't have all the information, but I think any path to wanting to change your perspective on the world would drive you away from most marriages, but especially Norm.
Oh, right.
I mean, like, he doesn't seem like someone who's comfortable with that.
Right. It was totally nothing we talked about.
Yeah.
But actually, it was also Andrew, because I've always been aware of some way evolution. And I could see that in his life, he was having an evolution because of his career.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone from being a teacher to a coach to a dean of boys to a vice principal to a principal. And, you know, I had done the mother thing and done work that I was like going forward in my little things.
Mm-hmm.
But that was all over. And I never wanted to be stagnant.
Yeah.
As a person,
mm-hmm.
let alone just be the little wife.
You've always done a good job at not being stagnant as a person. I think that's
that was kind of a conflict
there.
But mm-hmm. that was something that was a driving force for me not to be stagnant.
So yeah.
The next thing I did was Est. Your mom and I did Est.
Oh,
Earhart Seminary seminar training. And that was... you know, we learned a lot at the time. It was one of the things, I don't know how much is productive today,
uh-huh.
but at the time it really made me, the first thing it ever taught me was to read instructions, which sounds so strange, but up until then I would never even look at an instruction. So there were many more things that it taught me, but it was, and it broadened my mind.
I love reading instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I have... another one that I want to ask. I hope this doesn't stop on us, but whatever. Who cares? And this is a big one, kind of. But throughout your life, this is one that I thought came up with. There's been like a lot of different social change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's been different, what people now break up into kind of different sections of social change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that be, you know, the civil rights movement, women's liberation, gay rights, whatever the hell's going on now with social media changing our society.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question is, as someone who's an I, who's got a self or doesn't or whatever, like, how have the different periods of social change felt different to you? Like, from where you sit, is it feel like it's faster changing now than it was then? Or does it feel, I mean, it seems like it's always been turbulent to me looking back, but I don't know how it would feel to actually have gone through all that different stuff.
Well, without giving any deep thought to it, I think there was a certain thing, like I could just picture like things opening up and closing up. And when Kennedy, for example, and I wasn't too much aware of anything except I knew my dad loved Roosevelt. And so I therefore loved him too. But when...
FDR.
Yes, he just loved him. So because he actually brought some jobs and things to people, and that's what they were needing at that time, because that was right after the Depression or during. So the thing was, when Kennedy came, don't ask, you know, such cliche words, but ask not what, you know, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I think it opened up a lot of energy and people thinking, well, what can I do? And they had the peace, you know, I'm not sure the sequence of things, but I think things felt opening up. But then right so quick after that, when they had all those assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
As a young adult, I remember I actually cried and stayed in bed and cried for a day and a half about